Last-minute reprieve came during a nationwide campaign by Native Americans to raise funds to buy the land.
Native Americans have spent the last week scrambling to raise enough money to counter the anticipated millions that would be bid for Peshla, a sacred site in the center of the Black Hills. With more than $1 million in support pledged, the grassroots effort to save the sacred land came to a temporary halt. Lakota Elder Rosalie Little Thunder says her people are hopeful, but cautious. Little Thunder says that although she had trust in a higher power, the auction's cancellation was a pleasant surprise.
If I'm trusting in what we call Takushkashkan, which is the spiritual energy, I'm not surprised in one sense. In another sense, I guess it's something none of us expected. That's something we wanted, but, you know, it seemed unrealistic. And I'm sure the family, you know, is under duress. They must have given it a lot of thought and probably had a lot of discussion.
Little Thunder thanked the Reynolds family for caring for the land over the last few generations. She hopes Native American tribes can keep the momentum going and negotiate with the family to purchase the property. The Reynolds family declined to comment on what prompted the auction's cancellation. For National Native News, I'm Jim Kent in the Black Hills.
For the third year in a row, the wild rice crop is poor in northern Wisconsin, not from drought, but from flooding and a warm winter. Mike Simonson has more.
A few scattered rice beds look good, but Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission biologist Peter David says this is a bad year across the region.
East central Minnesota, kind of the area from Duluth out to the Big Sandy Lake complex and down to Mille Lacs, that area is bad as I've ever seen it, almost a total failure on many, many important rice lakes that way. Northwest Wisconsin fares a little bit better, but certainly well below average.
David does say northeastern Wisconsin is better, but even that is below par. He says the June 20th flood up north is part of the reason.
Took rice that was in that floating leaf stage and probably drowned it or ended up essentially pulling it out of the bottom as those water levels jumped up. But sort of the very broad distribution of poor beds that we're seeing here also suggests there may be some other factors at work.
Other factors could include climate change. David says wild rice is designed for northern climates. Warmer temperatures, including recent mild winters, hurt germination and can lead to fungal disease. David says the bad wild rice crop hits tribes the hardest.
They kind of count on it. I'm putting some food on the table, and it's tough because this is the third fairly poor year in a row in northern Wisconsin, so there's sort of a cumulative effect going on there.
The wild rice harvest season will start in this region in about a week. For National Native News, I'm Mike Simonson.
During this month in 2003, the National Park Service turned over 3 centuries-old buffalo hide shields to the Navajo Nation. They were found in Utah in the 1920s, hidden in a rock crevice. The Navajo Nation and other tribes filed a claim under the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act to recover the items, which had been on display at Capitol Reef National Park. The Navajo Nation claimed the shields were sacred objects needed by traditional religious leaders to practice the Protection Way ceremony. The tribe claimed they were made by Mini Goat Whitehair and 4 other men and used in a battle with the Spanish. After the battle, Mini Goat Whitehair hid the 3 shields and prayed that they would be found in the future. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kowanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the McCune Charitable Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation. And by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's 5 and a half, well, almost 6 minutes after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News. Pat Moore hosting today on Juneau Afternoon. My first guest is another. Last week we had one of the faculty, new faculty members out at UAS, and now we have the new and for a long time, I think, one of the first economics professors to be part of the faculty at UAS. It's been taught, I think, by adjunct faculty members quite a bit. So welcome, Brian Vandernault.
Thanks, Pat.
Yeah. So, Brian, where did you come up from?
Most recently hailed from Eugene, Oregon, where I finished my doctoral degree.
Oh, okay. And before that?
Missoula, Montana, where I did my master's.
Mm-hmm. And you're an East Coast boy originally, right? Well, Midwest.
Midwestern, that's right.
Yeah, from out of Cincinnati, did you say?
Yeah, pretty much Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, and Ohio is where I was raised.
Yeah, so you're moving into a new element. Welcome to not 100 degree days, and you can't get up on a box and look from Kansas to Indiana anymore. But
that's right. We like it.
Yeah, do you? Yeah. Well, you lived out west long enough, but I guess you can do that. So, what attracted you to Juneau? What made you apply for this position?
An adventure, in one word. I've always actually had this romantic dream that I would one day live in Alaska, and when this position came open, I thought, oh, very convenient.
Where'd the dream come from?
Ever since I was a kid, I've been kind of very active outdoors, and my best friend and I have been backpacking in the mountains for a very long time, and we've actually been talking about moving to Alaska for a very long time. He's in Wyoming, so he's halfway there.
Mm-hmm. And what was the Alaskan draw?
The wildness of it. In my mind, it's literally the last frontier, and there's so many opportunities for outdoor recreation. It seems like Juneau's got almost all of them within a very small radius.
So somebody once defined wilderness as a place where you are not eating, but you can be eaten, which maybe that's the appeal.
Could even describe downtown Juneau.
mayhap, I'm not sure. Anyway, so you are going to be part of which school out of the UAS?
Arts and Sciences, the Department of Social Sciences.
Okay, so UAS has, I think, 4 schools, right? Arts and Sciences, School of Management, School of Education, and Career Education.
I believe that's correct.
Yeah, and so the School of Arts and Sciences, I think, is the largest of those four.
Mm-hmm.
And has the most on-campus enrollment.
I believe that's correct.
Right. I think that's right, yeah. Anyway, so they haven't had an economics professor on faculty. I don't know if people know that there's a kind of a distinction made between permanent faculty members and adjunct professors who are basically members of the community or other people who are hired to teach one or two courses for the institution rather than those who are part of the faculty itself. So you're joining this faculty, and you're newly out of graduate school. How's that feel?
It's exciting and daunting at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of look at the shoes that I have to fill and wonder how I'm going to do it, and yet I'm really excited to try to do it.
So will you have, are there majors in economics? Will you have majors that you'll be working with?
As I understand, the social science major has certain disciplines you can emphasize, and economics is one of those emphases.
So if a student is taking the economics emphasis in a social sciences major, that would become a person that you would advise?
That's correct.
What's the role of an advisor in relationship to a student?
That I'm still learning about mm-hmm. since I'm new. I believe the role is to kind of guide that student through the waters that are the undergrad experience.
Did you have advisors in your undergrad experience?
I must have, but I don't.
How about in your graduate experience? That's more recent.
I did, yeah. Particularly in my PhD program, I had excellent advisors at the University of Oregon.
And did they guide you through the waters?
They did.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were very helpful.
Well, I think that's the model, is someone who can be helpful and make sense of the chaos that is going on around you when you're a student.
I agree.
So you'll be teaching a course this fall in natural resource economics?
That's correct.
Can you define that? What are the economics of natural? How do you take the science of economics and rub it up against natural resources?
Great question. So we're going to define natural resources that we study in natural resource economics as those that are direct inputs into some production process. So we're talking about gold, oil, water, coal, as opposed to environmental economics, which tends to examine the back end of that. So, for instance, when you extract coal, that's a natural resource issue. When you look at the pollution produced by a coal-fired power plant, that's an environmental economics issue. And we've got lots of natural resource issues in Southeast Alaska, the Kensington Mine, and we've got statewide oil and lots of other things like that.
How much of that will you be able to bring into the class? In other words, how much can you localize it?
I hope to mostly localize it.
Okay, is this like a what level is the class being taught in?
It's 435.
Okay, so it's a senior class, level class. Okay, so you're looking for students that have already gone through 3-4 years, or they're in their fourth year normally.
Right, or actually the only prerequisite.
UAS doesn't limit enrollment. I think a freshman could actually enroll in the thing, but do you have a prereq for the class?
Yeah, principles of micro.
Okay.
Or my express written permission.
So most of them are, almost all of your students are going to have gone through a microeconomics class.
That's right.
So they'll be familiar with the basic part of microeconomics. So this is kind of an application of economics to the marketing of resources or the production of resources?
So this is an application of economic tools to analyze why we extract certain amounts of gold, for example. So we're going to look at current prices and future prices of gold. Same thing with coal. And actually, there are lots of different categories of problems that we could go into. Another interesting one is natural resource accounting. You've probably heard the buzz term payments for ecosystem services.
Hmm.
Throughout the class, I plan on using academic literature as well as periodicals such as The Economist and New York Times and Wall Street Journal to kind of give students a sense of what's going on both in the media and on the cutting edge of where research is going in this area. So I also, on the first day of class, I'm going to take input as to what they might be interested in pursuing in the class.
Do you have enrollment yet?
We've got 3 kids in the class.
Okay.
So we hope to get more.
So the class is open and available.
That's right.
It sounds like an opportunity to take the first regular faculty member taught economics course at UAS for some time here. Will you be teaching other courses this fall?
Yes. I'm also teaching a Principles of Microeconomics course.
Oh, okay. The prereq for this class next time you offer it, right?
That's right.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Will you offer this class regularly, the resource natural resource economics?
I hope to. It's currently on the books for every other year,
mm-hmm.
and I hope to continue that.
So now that you're here, you mentioned that that you're looking forward to lots of opportunities in Juneau. Have you had a chance to get out and look the place over, or did you just walk off the ferry and come into the studio?
We walked off the ferry and hiked Mount Juneau and ran around Douglas Island and hiked the Rainforest Trail and examined bears at the glacier. Drove out the road, so we've done some things. So
Brian,
far.
You've been busy.
Yeah.
You've gotten around a little bit.
Indeed.
So the we in that sentence was a family?
My wife.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay, and have you've got a place to live? And
we do. We're just in West Juneau there.
Uh-huh. Okay, so good to have you joining the community, and we'll look forward to hearing more about the good offerings you'll be putting together out at UAS.
Thanks, Pat.
Thanks so much for coming down from the UAS campus. Brian Vandernault, I think it's Dr. Brian Vandernault, who is the new economics professor at the University of Alaska Southeast. A little music by Vince Guaraldi here. the master, Vince Guaraldi. It's off of an album of famous hits. I love that that piano. Anyway, Colette's here from Gold Town Theater, and going to tell us about a program that's coming up, which when I saw the listing of eight documentaries, I envisioned that people would be chained to their seats for several hours. But she says they're actually going to be spread out over time. So,
well, yeah. We do like to chain people to the seats. It really helps keep your audience riveted.
Yes.
That actually costs extra to do that. We have to bring in some experts, and of course that's 21 and over.
Yeah.
But or it's like 5 and under. You can bring your kids down, and we just chain them all together.
That's good. Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of a Gold Town child rearing policy, but it's a step up. Usually, I just put them all in like a big tub and just let them sit there.
Colette, I'm hearing sirens in the background. We should probably move into the material.
No, we don't even like kids at the theater, so that's a total lie.
Yeah, I know. I can tell. You never do anything kid friendly. So, eight documentaries from around the world.
At least.
There's more.
Every time I turn around, there's another one.
But wait, there's more.
Well, technically, there are six in what I'm calling the DocFest series, and those six are like a Monday, Tuesday, Saturday thing. They're kind of, I don't want to call them filler, because they're all great films, but I have my regular feature films on the weekends.
Okay.
And then there's just been so many really good documentaries coming out lately, and it's hard to cycle them all in. And honestly, unless it's a really big release like this Ai Weiwei movie, a lot of docs have what I consider kind of a limited niche appeal. So I figure I'll hit them for a couple days. The people who really want to see them will make an effort to see them and get a couple evening shows, a couple matinees on the weekends, and give you some time to see it.
So will all of these documentaries show on the same schedule?
Pretty much.
Okay, so what is that schedule?
It'll be Monday, Tuesday evenings, and Saturday early afternoon, I think 2 o'clock. Hmm. Oh, and I think I put a Saturday late, like a Saturday 9 p.m., but it's all standard.
Okay.
And I'm actually still writing out the quote-unquote summer afternoon shows as well for a while, even though it's never been summer and never looked like summer. And so I figure, retirees and they have the day free. They need something to do at 4:30 in the afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
So Monday, Tuesday, 4:30, do that. So it's basically Monday, Tuesday, 4:37, Saturday, 2 and 9.
Okay.
And that'll be sort of the standard.
So each documentary then, it sounds like, will air five times or show five times when it's here.
Yeah.
So what are the shows?
It's crazy. We just kicked it off with this new documentary called Ai Weiwei, Never Sorry, about the Chinese artist. It's a fantastic film. I don't care if you hate art, if you have no interest in China. It's so much more than that. And he's such a great figure of our time right now. He's a very impressive, outspoken defender of democracy and freedom of speech and individualism. It's especially in China, it's for the Chinese government, that's a very dangerous thing, and it's a very dangerous thing for him. He's already been detained twice mysteriously for weeks at a time, and and a lot of people like him have just flat out disappeared.
This documentary has won, it hasn't won awards yet, I don't think, but what has happened is that there are reviewers who are giving it like 3-star reviews. The kind of thing that you usually see about a feature film.
Mm-hmm.
So this is really a well-produced documentary, as well as being really interesting as to the subject.
Yeah, and this director, Clayman, was, I think she and Ai Weiwei had a mutual friend, so she was given pretty unprecedented access to his life. It's very personal at times. He talks about his family, and he's got a little boy now. But it also covers his past. He lived in New York for a couple of years as a student, and it covers clearly his present work. He designed the birdhouse at the Beijing Olympics in 2008,
and then refused to go into it.
Yeah, which he then famously boycotted, very publicly so too. And it's for this particular distributor, which is IFC, the independent film channel. This is one of their big release titles of the summer, really, and of the year. So we have Ai Weiwei. We have next week we start with the Donald Trump documentary. You've Been Trumped. Donald Trump versus Scotland. Who knows who's going to win? But it's going to be ugly. Donald's been trying to build this incredible golf course in the middle of Scotland's biggest nature reserve for years. So local guy just started filming it, and it's pretty. Why do people want to make the Scottish mad? They've done nothing from Braveheart. We have Donald Trump. Then we have this great one called The Queen of Versailles about David Siegel, who was this multi-billionaire timeshare mogul with his trophy wife. They had 8 kids, and then everything completely collapsed from under them. They were building the largest home in America, 90,000 square feet, and everything just came to a screeching halt. It's just a fascinating character study. It's a, you know, riches to rags story, they're calling it. And they are, both of them, just out there individuals. And it's a really, really bizarre little story. We have those guys. We have, so that's, I'm calling that my 1%. And then we have my 99%.
Oh, okay.
Which includes a movie called Meet the Falcons, about a couple of sisters. They're about 69 years old. They're the oldest continually working prostitutes in the Red Light District in Amsterdam.
Ah.
This is a rated R feature. Mm-hmm. It is fairly explicit. And it's really fascinating.
Yeah.
And it's not just about sex. Mm-hmm. It's also about caring and other strange things, leather, whatnot. But they're really a couple of great old birds with their stories. And then I just signed up for this other new one called Beauty is Embarrassing. And I'm embarrassed to say myself, I can't remember the name of the guy who's the subject of it, which is a bad thing to admit on radio. But he was the main creative force behind most of the Pee-wee's Playhouse, the Pee-wee's Adventure, the characters, the couch, Large Marge, all that. But he's this puppeteer and animator and artist and multimedia artist who's done work with, like, the band Primus on the Primus videos, obviously Pee-wee's Playhouse. I think he helped design most of the Blue's Clues, but he's just done just crazy creative stuff all over the place. I'm missing a big one. It'll come to me. Oh, 5 Broken Cameras, of course, which is an Israeli documentary, and it chronicles this man's life in the
who just would never stop filming.
Never.
Yeah.
And basically it's about the life.
His wife is screaming at him in some of the scenes saying, quit that.
Yeah.
You're going to kill us all.
Yeah. And it's basically how 5 of his cameras got destroyed over between this, you know, the settlement in Israel. And it's a very powerful documentary. It's also getting great reviews. And then the other one I really wanted to get real quick was this one we're doing this weekend called Music from the Big House, which is a little Canadian film about this woman who's the Canadian Queen of the Blues, Rita Shirelli, and she makes a visit to the Mississippi State Penitentiary, which is Angola Prison, which is at one time the bloodiest prison in America, I think. And she produces a series of blues concerts with the inmates there. And so it kind of follows her meeting these guys, setting up these concerts, and performing with them as well. It's a very, you know, it's one of those music from the inside kind of thing. And that's only for 2 days this weekend. And the Saturday 9 p.m. show of that is actually going to feature a little short live blues concert beforehand with Sammy Burroughs and C. Scott Frey.
All right.
It'll be a really great little evening, and I'm just going to do $10 tickets. I'm not going to inflate the price any more than that, and the proceeds will go to the musicians.
Okay, Colette, when you were talking, you said that you just signed up for it.
Right.
You got to tell us.
secret.
No, come on now. How do you do this?
It's very complicated.
Like, how did you get the Ai Weiwei? I mean, that thing is being reviewed right now in magazines across the country and on television and every place else. And it's like airing in small hot houses in New York City.
Well, we're a hot house.
I understand that, but we're in general Alaska. This is the end of the world up here. So tell me how you're doing this kind of thing.
Well, it's a very complicated series of emails between myself and the distributor. Well, the lucky thing for us, anyway, is particularly with documentaries, unless a documentary is like just the greatest thing since sliced bread, which many of them are, but they're not feature film releases. They're not Hollywood releases. It's been out for over a month now.
Yeah.
It's still getting a lot of press. And so we don't, even for big releases like this, we can't get them right away because they're only going to certain markets. Once they start a larger rollout, we can kind of qualify because there's no one else that's doing it around us, honestly. We're not close enough to Seattle to infringe on their market. And you know, Gross doesn't generally do documentaries, and so we are kind of very lucky in our remoteness that we can kind of grab.
I keep telling people when people say to me, you know, that it's horrible that you can only fly and get a boat into here.
Yeah.
That is one of our biggest assets. Is the other way you got to think about that, because we would not have the things that we have, like Gold Town, like Perseverance, like the music festival, like all of this stuff, if we didn't have to roll about half of it on our own.
It's a big hook.
And yeah, and it's the guts of people in town who will go through that kind of process to get us the kinds of entertainment that we have around here.
I agree.
Yeah, that make this a special place.
Because often you can, I mean, I just emailed a distributor the other day about another great new doc coming out called Side by Side, and it's co-produced and hosted by Keanu Reeves, and he's exploring this whole new digital revolution within cinema.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes and interviews all the big names right now. And, I mean, he's interviewing Josh Whedon and Martin Scorsese and, I mean, all the biggest names within the field, talking to them about, you know, George Lucas and, of course, all the big digital guys about, you know, what's happening, how is this different, you know, what is this digital revolution talking about, and get some really, really great interviews going on. And that one is only hitting big markets. I emailed the distributor, who also happens to be the producer, and his first line was, "Wow, Alaska, never thought I'd see that."
Are we getting it?
We are getting it.
All right.
Yeah.
Part of this series? Or?
Well, it wasn't supposed to be part of the series, but it literally kind of just came up. I'm able to get it very soon. So I think I'm gonna put that in near the top of September. So, and that's I'm very much looking forward to that. It's a little bit of a film geek thing, but this digital revolution is it's the biggest impact in cinema since the invention of sound, and it's having the biggest impact on theaters certainly since then. I mean, they're talking about anywhere between 10 and 20,000 art house theaters shutting down over the next year in America because of this digital process. And then another who knows how many thousands within the next year, once 35 is over with, which will happen probably within the next year or so.
35 millimeter film.
Correct. And everything goes to this digital package. If you can't, I mean, the mantra of this group is convert or die. And that's pretty much what's sort of coming down the
pipe. So are you digitized?
We are not digitized.
What are you going to do?
We are going to figure out a game plan.
Yeah.
We have a couple options that are very interesting. We can either raise $100,000 to pay for the conversion. Somehow that seems easy enough. But there are actually a couple options that are available to theaters specifically of our size that involve a broker and some other things. So, I mean, we're certainly not going to give up the ghost. And there's plenty of smaller distributors that we can get really good material from that can certainly make up the bulk of what we do.
Yeah.
So,
but eventually you're going to have to.
Oh, probably. If we want to keep getting the bigger stuff for sure.
So the next one of these, the first one of these is?
Well, we've got Ai Weiwei this week.
Okay,
all week long.
So it's, give me the times and days again.
Oh, boy.
Ai Weiwei on, you said?
It's Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So today, in fact, I got to get down there soon. It's today 4, 7, and 9.
Okay.
Saturday, I think just 7 on Saturday. Sunday, 4 and 7.
You got airtimes up on the web someplace?
For sure.
Yeah, okay.
For
so just
yep.
Google Gold Town Theater, Juno, and the...
Goldtown, Nick.
Goldtown.
.com.
Okay,
yeah.
Good.
And right. Then and music from the Big House this weekend, Saturday, 2, 4, and 9, Sunday, 2 o'clock.
Well, hey, it's 3:32. You better
go
fire up the projector and get going for that thing.
I got to go work out some popcorn, kids.
Yeah, all right.
All right, thanks a lot. Appreciate
it. Thanks for coming by.
You're welcome.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 24th of August, 2012. It's the birthday of the writer Jorge Luis Borges, born in Buenos Aires in 1899. In 1955, at about the same time that he lost his sight, Borges was appointed director of Argentina's National Public Library. Borges said, "Little by little I came to realize the strange irony of events. I had always imagined paradise as a kind of library. Others think of a garden were of a palace. There I was, the center, in a way, of 900,000 books in various languages, but I found I could barely make out the title pages and the spines. And I wrote the poem of the gifts, which begins, "No one should read self-pity or reproach into this statement of the majesty of God, who with such splendid irony granted me books and blindness at one touch." After he went blind, Borges turned from writing prose fiction to formal poetry, dictated his writing to his mother, who worked as his personal secretary. It's the birthday of the poet Robert Herrick, born London, 1591, grew up poor in a large family, became a clergyman, hung out in taverns in London, and when he was 39, left his taverns behind him and became a vicar in a little village in Devon, where he lived for more than 30 years. Robert Herrick, who wrote more than 2,500 poems, including To the Virgins, To Make Much of Time, which begins, "Gather ye rosebuds while ye may, old time," is still a-flying, and this same flower that smiles today, tomorrow will be dying. And it was on this day in the year 410 that Rome was sacked by the Visigoths, led by a man named Alaric. They came from what is now Germany. They had suffered at the hands of the Roman Empire, suffered under the burden of Roman taxes, and they started moving toward Rome. They began a siege of the city. The Romans tried to pay them off, but they didn't offer enough gold and silver, and the Visigoths sacked the city, which the historian Edward Gibbon called the greatest and most awful scene in the history of mankind. Here's a poem by Jim Harrison entitled Debtors. They used to say we're living on borrowed time, but even when young, I wondered who loaned it to us. In 1948, one grandpa died, stretched tight in a misty oxygen tent. His four sons gathered, his papery hand grasping mine. Only a week before, we were fishing. Now the four sons have all run out of borrowed time, while I'm alive, wondering whom I owe for this indisputable gift of existence. Of course, time is running out. It always has been a creek heading east, the freight of water with its surprising heaviness following the slant of the land, its destiny. What is lovelier than a creek or riverine thicket? Say it is an unknown benefactor who gave us birds and Mozart, the mystery of trees and water, and all living things borrowing time. Would I still love the creek if I lasted forever? Debtors, a poem by Jim Harrison from Songs of Unreason, published by Copper Canyon Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, iPad users can download the three most recent issues of Poetry Magazine, celebrating its centennial in 2012, at poetryfoundation.org. And by the Mosaic Foundation of Rita and Peter Hayden, based in Ann Arbor, honoring the literary arts and the universe of great ideas. Written by Betsy Alistair, edited by Joy Biles. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
About 28 minutes before 4 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News. We're in the middle of Juneau afternoon. Pat Moore hosting today. My next two guests are the force behind our Perseverance Theater. I think we've mentioned Perseverance Theater about 4 times on today's program. You weren't here, but there were guests who were new to the area, and we were talking about all the wonderful things that go on here in Juneau. And Colette was here, and we were talking about this series that she's putting together of documentaries down at the Gold Town. And I said something about the fact that we have these wonderful resources, including Perseverance Theater and like that. So you guys have been commercialized today already. You don't have to do anything else.
We're so, so lucky.
Yeah, yeah. So thanks for coming down.
Thank you.
No, thanks for coming down, really. And you've got a season coming up of a set of five plays, and then you're playing one up in Anchorage, right?
Yeah, we'll have five stars in Juneau and three in Anchorage, and I have Boston.
Yeah, and Boston's with us, who's directing a couple of plays this year. And
I'm directing one, and I'm acting in one.
So the Juneau lineup, we're in rehearsal right now for Of Mice and Men, mm-hmm. the John Steinbeck classic. We're doing his own adaptation. He wrote the book and the play kind of at the same time. And then we're doing Oklahoma instead of a holiday show this year, so that'll run over the Thanksgiving holiday, so it'll be a great thing to take the whole family to when they're visiting. And then after the new year, our first ever production by Harold Pinter, the Nobel Prize-winning British writer, Betrayal, one of his most famous works. There's a terrific film about it. And then our contemporary play, we usually look for a hot new play that's kind of out on the national scene. This year it's Seminar by Teresa Rebeck, which closed on Broadway in May, so we're one of the first regional theaters to get regional rights to it. And then our world premiere this year is The Road Weeps, The Well Runs Dry by Marcus Gardley. Marcus is a young African-American writer, and this is an epic work set in the Black Seminole community in the 19th century, so we're lucky to be working with him. He's really quite something.
This is there's a pattern that you went through as you were talking, mm-hmm. and so that it doesn't get away from us. You try to have a certain collection of plays in your season.
I think so. We spend a lot of time thinking about what makes a good season. In fact, we're in the middle right now of talking about lineups for the 13-14 season. That's about how far out we have to work. And there's usually a world premiere because we think that it's healthy and good for theater artists to work with living writers and to experience what that is. And it's something we've come to expect of ourselves. Sometimes it's a nationally based writer like Marcus. Other times it's someone who lives here, like we recently did a Dave Hunsaker play, and we're working on an Ishmael Hope play for a future season. So, you know, maybe alternating roughly between those two things, about half of the world premieres are Alaskan writing and half are not. And I think for all of us who live here and love theater, it's really fun to look for something like Seminar, or the year before it was Rajiv Joseph's Animals Out of Paper. We did a play called Boom a few years ago about a blind date to the end of the world. And those were plays that were really popular around the country, and they just give us a way of connecting to what's happening in the American theater and in America as a whole, just in our cultural scene. And it's just nice not to have to leave Juneau to be able to see at least one of those every year. So we try to find something that's exciting that way.
Boston, you're playing in Mice and Men?
Yes, I'm playing Lenny Small, the classic character. And so if I'm a little slow today, forgive me.
Okay, I'll try to make things real simple for you.
It is interesting to me because I also work at the theater on staff, and so it's been an interesting challenge to you know, work in your head all day intellectually and then go to rehearsal and try to tap into the character that is Lenny. And it's been a fantastic journey so far. We've been in rehearsal for a few weeks now, and we've got some wonderful people in that one. A few people from Anchorage have come down. Dick Reichman, who was in Christmas Carol last year, is in the show. Kevin Bennett is in the show. And then we have some great talent from our local scene here. Brandon Demery is in it, and Roblin Gray Davis is in it, and a bunch of others. Jerry Demert's in it. And it's been really great. And Art, this is Art's directorial debut, I believe.
It's true. Almost.
Yeah. Almost his directorial debut. Because Art is one of the only scene and lighting designer, a designer, to run a theater as an artistic director in the country. So this is his next challenge, is to start getting, you know, in charge of the whole show.
So you guys are friends and staff collaborators.
Right.
How does the gear shift work when you become director?
I think that's what I'm interested in figuring out. I haven't done that much of it, but this particular play means a lot to me, and I have had the chance to work on it before. I did the design, I think the whole design, I did the set and the lighting design for it in Sacramento, which was a great place to work on the play too, because it takes place not far from there. And I've been an admirer of Steinbeck. We were talking before the show about Steinbeck. He was someone that my grandfather knew well and read his books front to back, almost all of them, I would say, and he's been a big influence on me as probably Steinbeck and Melville are the two American novelists that I most admire. So,
so you come into this with this vision that you've got. Okay, but Boston's going to do something in the middle of this whole thing where you're going to have to say to him, "That's not what I want." How does that play out? I mean, do you let him go and show you something new about the piece, or do you hold him back and say, "No, it's going to have to be my way or the highway, kid"?
I think there's as many different styles as there are directors, but I'm interested in seeing what the actor brings and trying to create a good atmosphere for people to explore and find something, and then just try and edit from there.
Does it make you nervous to have him directing you?
No. It made me more nervous when I first came last year. I directed the 39 Steps last year, and I had just started working on staff, and then I was directing a show. And so you're doing two different things, where in the evening you're sort of in charge, and then in the day you're not, right? And so that was an interesting place, because he designed my lights last year, so it was my boss designing my lights.
Huh.
This time as an actor, you're already kind of in a place of wanting to trust your director, because you want to be able to just explore, and because this, especially my character, there's so many different things that could be said, done, played out with him, to be able to just kind of have the freedom to one day try something that's a little different and be able to have that freedom, and I think we trust each other I think we have a pretty honest relationship, and so that's freeing for me as an actor. And
Perseverance has got to be a totally organic place to work, because you guys are swapping roles all the time.
Right.
And it'd be hard to go get coffee without having to switch roles.
Yeah, we have a lot of, like, Shona Strausser, who's our education director, who's also, she's directing Oklahoma, so she'll switch into that chair, and then she's going to be in Betrayal, and I'll be directing her in that. So it's, we are cross, I don't know what the right word is. I don't think pollination is the right word, but we're crossing over in many different ways, and so we have to work together as a team, really.
I think somebody who works in a cubicle would have trouble understanding, with a defined job responsibility. You guys got to do everything.
Right.
All
right. Especially small theater companies like ours.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah. So, Mice and Men opens?
We open September 14th.
Okay.
There's some preview performances the week before.
And you're airing here until you're running here until October 7th.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then right after that, you pack the show up, and the end of October, you're up in Anchorage playing the same piece.
For 2 weekends.
Will
same
that be
piece?
The whole company going up?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, same set.
Big adaptation to change stages?
It's interesting.
I mean, Perseverance is its own world.
It sure is. Up there, our home is the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts, and it's the Sidney Lawrence Theater there, which is very wide. So the sets, actually, the ground plans of the set almost fit. Now, that being said, I mean, not quite, but almost fit perfectly. But that being said, the relationship between the performer and the audience is completely different, because our audience wraps around and they're very close and they look down on the stage, and up there they face one direction and more or less one direction and look up at the stage. So the physical relationship is really different. Fortunately, our playing space is a little bit harder to stage in, so it's a little bit easier. But, yeah, it's an adjustment period for sure.
So season tickets, I think, are currently being sold.
I
got something
absolutely
in the mail here a little bit ago.
Yeah, season tickets are on sale. You can still get them. And there's also options that we started last year, which is pick 3 or pick 4. So let's say you don't want to see the hot new play that's just coming off of Broadway, and that's the one play you don't want to see. You can still get a subscription and save a good significant amount over what you would pay if you were to buy singly. So it's definitely something to look at. You can go to the website and download the form. It gives you the prices. It ranges. Thursday and Sundays are the most affordable. You can get subscriptions on those nights as low as, $60, depending upon what kind of package you build, because you could do pick 3 as well. And then Fridays and Saturdays are a little bit more. And there's discounts for seniors and students.
Well, it's certainly welcome to be able to kind of mix it up and sort of construct your own theater season.
Absolutely.
Around what
and
you
we do
on.
Have a great benefit of if you do subscribe and for some reason you can't make it to that night, we have free exchanges. You can exchange your ticket into another night of the same value. If you go into a higher value, you just pay that slight difference in charge. But it's one of the best benefits of being a subscriber. We don't offer that to single ticket holders.
Outstanding. Okay, so the season opens September 7th and runs all the way through May 26th with the last showing of The Road Weeps, The Well Runs Dry. Posters are all over town, the website, lots of places to get information. Mm-hmm. Art, Boston, thank you so much for coming down and kind of opening the door on the season for us here.
Thank you, Pat.
And we'll have you back when these plays start to get closer.
Really? Thank you.
About 10 minutes before 4 o'clock. My next guest is Forrest Wagner. He's here to kind of bring us up to date on a program that's been in existence out at UAS for quite a while, the Outdoor Studies Program. Welcome, Forrest.
Hey, thanks, Pat. How are you?
Pretty good. Anything new?
We do have some new stuff going on, and I wanted to kind of get it out there for the listening audience. Probably the biggest news is we now have our own 4-year program as a standalone BLA, so 120 credits in
Bachelor of Liberal Arts.
Bachelor of Liberal Arts, 120 credits. Title is Outdoor and Adventure Leadership. And we also, in the last 2 years, actually 3 years ago, are included as an emphasis area in Bachelor of Arts in Geography and Environmental Studies. And so coming out of that, we have 4-year students, which is new. We started as a 1-year certificate program, and we've always had a strong liberal arts focus, but now we're really working with students year after year, and it's been really dynamic and exciting. And so one thing to note, we're taking students to Ecuador over Christmas this year as a graduation requirement.
Say hi to Julian Assange when you get down there.
We'll do. And we'll be down there, let's see, the 27th of December through, I guess, January 17th, climbing and skiing high-altitude volcanoes. So that's something that's pretty exciting that we're really happy to be able to, produce.
You're kind of the extreme sport of college degrees here. How unique is this program? Are there universities that have programs similar to this?
Sure. There's a spectrum of outdoor education available, but our program is it's unique for how we're presenting information. I mean, we really are liberal arts, interdisciplinary, and so a lot of programs are training people to be managers, to go out and work in the Forest Service or in other recreation fields, often continuing on to get a Master's of Arts in outdoor rec and running rec programs, and generally involve a lot of kind of management techniques, and we're really more focused on combination of philosophy and some science and English and various fields in the arts. And we do have a sequence of outdoor leadership classes, but I think by our nature, we're more academic than most. In addition, we have the resources of Southeast Alaska and the greater ranges of Alaska to work in, and now that we're doing the international programming, I think we do easily described as unique.
So what kinds of careers, I understand that college education is not all about career, but what kinds of careers would you envision some of your students finding themselves in 5 years after?
Well, that's a great question. In the field of tourism, we are very successful with placing our one-year or four-year students as mountain guides and trip leaders in any number of the seasonal offerings here in town. We have sent students on to work as interns in more intensive year-round mountain guiding schools and businesses. In addition, we place a lot of our students in agencies like the Forest Service or as land managers, and they may move on and take a master's degree in a science field. And so the field activities and the strong background in the liberal arts, I think, sets our students up, and most students really coming out of UAS, for any number of different careers in the state and then also in the country and abroad. They're fairly well-rounded, and one of the best things coming out of our program really is that they're easy to work with, hardworking people. We have a fairly involved application process, and we're vetting students, and a lot of this comes back to the ability to read and write, but also to think and make connections and creatively problem solve, which are those underlying goals of experiential education. And so this is very kind of John Dewey-esque, but it's also really exciting and fun. And so we're drawing students from all over the state and getting quite a few from down south now, too.
My background is in business education.
Yeah.
And one of the areas that we receive lots of feedback from industries was that the students who were coming out of business schools were very well prepared in their discipline, but that when they were faced with the necessity to think creatively, you used that phrase when you were talking, that they didn't have the liberal arts background that was probably necessary to be able to broaden their minds to go around a problem. So I think you've got a good formulation here.
Well, thanks. Yeah, we're certainly really excited to see this program grow. And I know I have limited time, so I want to just hit a couple classes for the listening public. The Kevin Meyer was on last week and mentioned the fly fishing course, which is happening the second week of September. We've got a few seats there. We just filled our swiftwater rescue course today. Our swiftwater rescue course. One's pretty exciting. You obviously need a strong swimming background, but it involves putting on a dry suit and practicing rescue techniques, primarily human-powered, swimming in the Mendenhall, which, as you know, is 34 degrees, and we have kayaks and rafts, but it's mostly involving kind of river safety, using some mechanical advantage, and learning about rivers and fluvial dynamics, to throw bigger words out there, and really fun. And so that's our first course of the year, but we just filled it today. I wanted to mention it, but we're out of seats there. I've still got seats in our backpacking course, and
when you say seats, however, when you're talking about river dynamics, it's not exactly a sit-down class.
That's right. There's one day of classroom and then 3 days of swimming in the Mendenhall.
Yeah, there you go.
The nice thing, Pat, about having a dry suit on is it doesn't matter if it's raining.
Well, a good thing for Juno.
Yeah. Well, the university is, constitutionally mandated, and so we're all actually public servants, and some of these classes really offer a strong safety background for our rich diversity of backcountry recreators that live here, and live here probably in part because of the outdoor opportunities. And so the Swiftwater Rescue course is one that I like to talk about because it's a good one for community members to think about before really getting into the whitewater sports that are a big part of our spring, summer, and fall, certainly once the snow flies. We've got an avalanche course and then a level 2 course. I teach climbing classes. Uh-huh. I have a rock climbing class going up into the Yukon in third week of September, and then an ice climbing class, glacier travel, crevasse rescue class and a mountaineering class that we fly onto the ice field and ski.
You may have far and away the least boring college major at almost any university in the world.
Well, and one other thing to point out, that for Alaska residents and for students that gain residency in Alaska, this is the cheapest outdoor programming in the world.
Yeah.
And I'm happy to be a part of that.
Yeah. Forrest, thank you so much for bringing us up to date on the program. It sounds like you have some really exciting things, and congratulations on turning it finally into a four-year degree.
Hey, thank you, Pat.
You bet. Classic Thelonious taking us out of the show. Weather forecast just got updated. We're mostly cloudy tonight with isolated showers and then patchy fog late. Saturday, that patchy fog will clear in the morning with scattered showers and highs around 58. And Saturday night, mostly cloudy with a slight chance of rain in the evening, lows around 49. Tune in this time slot on Monday and listen to the TED Radio Hour, replacing Juno Afternoon for the day. You're in tune with KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas, and we also broadcast on a set of translators in the Valley and Auk Bay. You can tune to K276 AF at 103.1. Our signal is heard in Lemon and Slicer Creek at 101.7 on K269 AO. Gustavus hears us on K201 AM. We're on 88.1 megahertz in Gustavus. We're at 91.9 on the FM dial in Juno over K220 BT. Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait hear us on K210 AS at 89.9. And in Juneau, you can get us on GCI Cable Juneau, digital channel 87. KRNN is on 872, and KXLL is on 873.